It's Erev Tov. Welcome everybody to thank you to Daniel for hosting.
Thank you for coming.
And so as part of our West Side Sephardic Synagogue lecture series, we move on to the next three-part series, which I'm very excited to teach because the I learned a lot of new information preparing for this Shiur series. And what I want to do here is, well, the topic is the story behind the writing of the Shulchan Aruch. Now, the Shulchan Aruch is the most important work in halacha. In the entire history of halacha, spanning 3,000 years, it is the most important work of practical halacha, the Shulchan Aruch. And we are going to study many things related to it, what came before it, why it was written, how it was written, who wrote it, and then what came afterwards. And in the process of studying about the historical, how the Shulchan Aruch came to be written, we're going to learn a lot about some meta-halacha questions of what is halacha, how is it written, who decides, how is it passed down, what are the different ways of transmitting halacha, and what are the different schools of thought, and the different communities, and different ways of interpreting halacha. So this is going to be really an exploration in the journey of the halachic process, and I hope that you will walk away from here getting a better understanding, a big picture of how the halachic process works, how we got to the customs that we have today, where they came from, how they got to where they are, and maybe we'll get a sense of where they're going. So,
can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
How did you come up with the idea to give a class on that?
This topic?
Yeah.
Well, it's I first became interested in this topic when I read an article by Professor Rabbi Yitzchak Twersky, who's the head of the Judaic Studies Department at Harvard University. And he wrote a book about the writing of the Shulchan Aruch. And so I've used that. That forms a very significant part of my research. But I've looked beyond that and drawn from that and in different areas. And so so that's the starting point, at least. From my standpoint, it's an excellent article. I'll be happy to send it out if you want to read it. But we're going to study some of it, so you'll get it inside. Okay, so let's. There's really an amazing story behind the writing of the Shulchan Aruch. And if you have no idea what the Shulchan Aruch is, that's fine. I'll just tell you. Basically, it means. Anyone know what it means? Shulchan Aruch.
Table.
It means the set table. Set table. Very good. Very good. This is going to be a perfect metaphor. So it's called the set table. And the story begins. Anybody know when the Shulchan Aruch was written, around what period in history, and where? Anybody know the location and the time?
Tzfat 1560.
Good. Tzfat 1560 is correct. But the story begins 40 years earlier, in 1522. And that is when a young rabbi by the name of Rabbi Yosef Karo decided to write a work. And it was going to become an encyclopedic work. And this is not the Shulchan Aruch. This is going to be another work. We're going to see what the name is called in just a little bit. Now let's talk about Rav Yosef Karo a little bit. Rav Yosef Karo, and you have here, we'll go through the chart, the map in just a little bit. Rav Yosef Karo is born in 1488. Anybody know where he's born? Yeah?
Lisbon.
Close. Very close.
In Portugal.
In Toledo. He's born in Toledo in 1488. And what happens then 4 years later in 1492? His family is expelled from Spain and they go to Portugal, to Lisbon, exactly. They go to Lisbon and they follow the path of many Sephardic families of this time. They go to Lisbon, but then they're kicked out of Lisbon in 1497, 5 years later. So then they go all the way east. They go to the Ottoman Empire, which is where many Jews took refuge. They go to Salonika. And they go to, a bunch of different cities, wherever it is within the Ottoman Empire. And finally, in 1535, Rav Yosef Karo arrives in Tzfat. Now, where is Tzfat? Tzfat is in the Galil, in northern Israel. Okay? And has anyone here taken a tour down the ancient city of Tzfat? Right? The ancient city of Tzfat is the city that Rav Yosef Karo that he was living in. In fact, has anybody here been to, there's a shul, the Rav Yosef Karo, which has like blue, it's a blue sky shul. The whole thing is blue, light blue.
The Ari shul, no?
There's the Ari shul also. Also, yeah, but the Rav Yosef Karo shul, whatever, if you'll go there, Bezrat Hashem is coming, Trip Michael, you'll go to the the Rav Yosef Karo Shul. He has a shul in Tzfat. But in 1522, even 15 years before arriving in Tzfat, he decided that he had to write a work of halacha. That there was a need, there was a demand. That okay, there's a need in the hour of in Jewish history to write a certain work. And we're going to see what that work is in just a second. But let's just talk about Tzfat for a second, because Tzfat is a really interesting place at this time. Tzfat is part of the Ottoman Empire. It's a central trading center within the Ottoman Empire. So you went from Tzfat, you know, to Istanbul, Constantinople, right? People would trade back and forth. And Tzfat is teeming with mystics. The study of Kabbalah takes on new forms and grows tremendously in Tzfat. Anybody know the most famous mystic of this time? What's his name? The Arizal is in Tzfat at this point in time, and he is sharing his Torah and spreading the Torah of the Arizal. And there's a new focus on Geula, on redemption. Why was there a new focus on redemption? Why was there, really an obsession with redemption at this point in time in Jewish thought? Why?
Was that after Shabtai
Tzvi? This is before Shabtai Tzvi. Okay. And the reason is because they just experienced a terrible expulsion. Okay, and Jewish history is it's like a pendulum; it swings back and forth. When terrible things happen, we hope there will be redemption. Okay, so there was the sense that redemption is coming, and in fact, somebody wrote a poem which we sing on a regular basis from Tzfat. A person by the name of Shlomo Alkabetz. Anybody know what this poem, this song is? L'chadudi, which we sing every Friday night. It was written in Tzfat. The Mekubalei Tzfat would go out to the fields, and they would sing L'chadudi, they would sing Kabbalat Shabbat out in the fields. Okay, they're very spiritual, very religious, and they would sing this, and they would say, let the beloved come back. This was a way of saying, let Shabbat come. Shabbat, they're welcoming the Shabbat, but they're also hoping that the divine presence is reunited, to use Kabbalistic terminology. And the Shekhinah will be reunited, and the world will be, we become whole again. It's been, the Shekhinah has been in exile, and they're hoping for things to return to its original, pristine, unified form. Now, there's also a renewal in halacha in this time in Tzfat. Because of this, all this excitement and optimism about the Jewish future, there's a certain rabbi by the name of Rav Yaakov Beirav who wants to reinstitute. Anybody know what he wants to reinstitute? The Sanhedrin. Okay, he wanted to reinstitute the Sanhedrin so that they can, they'd be able to adjudicate on many areas of halacha that we cannot adjudicate upon without a Sanhedrin, and also be able to impose certain penalties for violations. And there's a huge debate between the rabbis of Tzfat and Yerushalayim. In the end, the first rabbi to be given smicha, to be given this honorary title, going back to Moshe Rabbeinu, to be given smicha, which means that the rabbinical tradition is passed down to you. Anyone know who the first student was? The first student, or the second at least, is Rav Yosef Karo. So he's going to be given, but it sort of stops with him and two of or three of his students. It doesn't get passed on. They do not create a Sanhedrin in the end, because there was opposition to it. And the Rav Yosef Karo was also a Mikubal himself. He actually wrote a book. He composed a book called Magid Meisharim. He was a Kabbalist. And he had visions from angels, from this angel. And he wrote down all the visions that he had. And the work is called Magid Meisharim. Okay? He's a Magid. He had someone speaking to him in visions. And he wrote down the Torah that he studied. And so this is a little bit of the story of Rav Yosef Karo, who this person is. But most importantly, he is a tremendous Talmid Chacham. He is a sage that not every generation has a sage of his wisdom, of his scholarship, of his knowledge. And so let's study a work. We're going to study the introduction to the work that he decides to write. He decides to compose what is going to be an encyclopedic work on Jewish law. Okay, and we're going to read the introduction to this work, because if you read the introduction, you can understand the purpose of the author and why he felt compelled to write this work. So let's go
but
to the
Rambam did something like that.
We're going to see. We're going to get there. We're going to get there. Let's go to Rav Yosef Karo on the bottom here. Now, what I did here is I put down the Hakdama of the book is called the Hakdama LeBeit Yosef. This work is going to be called the Beit Yosef, the House of Joseph. Okay, now why Yosef? Because that's his name. Why Bayit? Well, we'll see when we get to the end of this why it's called Beit Yosef. Now, let's read this. Okay, now I took out a few lines, but we got the main thing here. V'yan ki archu lanu hayamim. And because the days have, Jewish history has, you know, ha'oraknu mikli al kli, the days have become long, and we have been thrown from vessel to vessel. Uvigola halachnu v'kama tzarot, tzarot, tukufot v'tzarot zulazu. And we've had persecutions and exiles and pogroms and all these terrible things happening to the Jewish people. The azlat yad ha-Torah v'lomdeh. And the Torah has lost its dignity. The Torah has lost its authority, its power. Why? Because of dispersion, right? It's hard to, if things are not going well economically and socially, okay, well, it's hard to study Torah all day, right? So it weakened, Torah study was weakening in his time. He was very concerned about this. The Torah, which was once one Torah sent from Moshe Rabbeinu down to the sages, is now turned into many different Torah. There are many different customs and many different ways of doing things and many different practices and many debates and there's confusion. There's no clarity. Everything is confused. Okay, the Sibot Rovas Freimanim Tzaim Beveyor Mishpatev Dinan. There's so many different books. There are millions of books, each explaining different customs, and it's not clear what one is supposed to do. V'im yomar adam b'chol din sheitztarech lachkor shorasho u'motzao b'divrei Hagmara v'amafarshim v'aposkim kulam yechaber hadavar alav me'od. Let's say a person takes one of these books of halacha. Okay, we'll take one book which was called the Agur. Okay, this is the name of that book, the Agur. It's a practical halachic book. Very simple, small book. And they want to understand the reasoning behind the halacha, the development, the evolution, the rationale. They have no idea where to turn to. They don't have computers. There's no internet. There's no Bar Ilan Responsa program or dot. There are no websites. And people didn't have access to these books. People didn't have the Sfarim that you have in your house. So one can only hope to have this many Sfarim in the Middle Ages, right? Mm-hmm. This was a big deal to have Sfarim, this many Sfarim. A person would be very wealthy. It could take 10 years to write out by hand the entire Encyclopedia Judaica that you have on your shelf, right? It could take years. You need a very good scribe to do it. In clear handwriting, you can imagine what happens if pogroms, persecutions, or some Christians decide to pillage a Jewish village. The whole set is burned down.
How long was it before people started printing?
1454 is Gutenberg, and then the first presses, I think, it's Cincino, if I'm not mistaken. Cincino is the first Jewish press soon after. But the point is that if you wanted to know the halacha and the Gemara, you didn't have a Gemara to look at, and you didn't know where it was in the Gemara. If I asked you, hey, where is the halacha about the following situation? Who here would be able to point with their fingertip on the Gemara and then show me what Balei Tosfot say and the Rishonim and all these? There's so many different commentaries. Where would you even start? Where would you even start? Okay, so this is the problem that they're dealing with. Kol shekein ki yil'alim tzoa petach ladat makom adin b'Talmud. Okay, all the more if you want to understand the rationale behind something in the Talmud. And now he goes on. V'hagam, third paragraph. Ki adam makom digmar yitzta'ech la'in kol ha-sugiyahi in perush Rashi v'tosafot. Person, if they want to understand the law, has to look at Rashi and the Tosvot. And then v'achakach lein b'divrei harif. These are all different commentaries. V'harosh, v'haran, v'hamordechi. You have to look at all these different commentaries. V'achakach harambam and all the other poskim. And how are you even going to know who to follow? Because there are all these different books. It's unclear who you're supposed to follow. Who is right? Okay, so let's go to the boldface words. You guys understand the problem? Mm-hmm. The problem's clear. Good. Al kein ani hadal be'al fei. And therefore I, who I am, one of the least of thousands, Yosef, b'morenu harav, Ephraim, b'morenu harav, Yosef Karo. Okay, this is Yosef, the son of Rabbi Ephraim, the son of Yosef, Karo, that's his name, Karo, I guess his last name, maybe he was from a place, Karo, whatever it is. Okay, Kaneti l'Hashem Tzvakot. What does Kaneti l'Hashem Tzvakot mean? What does that mean? What is kineti? It's to be zealous. I'm zealous for the Lord. Vinyarti chitzani lisakela b'mesila v'iskamti l'chaber sefer kolel kol hadinim hanoagim b'veyur shashem u'atzem me'agmara im kol chilukei sfarot poskim ish lo nedar. I decided to compile a work that will include everything. The Talmud, the Rishonim, all the different commentaries on the Talmud, all the different practical halachic books. He's going to write the encyclopedic work that includes everything. It's a big undertaking, right? Guess how long it's going to take him?
30 years.
Wow. 30 years. Okay? 30 years.
It's a lot of index cards.
Okay? It's a lot of index cards. That's right. 30 years. And he didn't have a computer. And he didn't have Word docs. And he didn't have Google docs. And okay? That's how long he's at. Now, Now we have to start thinking about, well, what books were there before his that might be useful to him? I mean, he's not starting from nothing, right? But he still needs to draw a tremendous amount of information together from different works. So he says, "V'ala b'dati l'samcho l'sefer ha-Rambam." I thought that maybe I should write it based on the Rambam. Take the Rambam and then expand upon it. And we're going to talk about the Rambam in depth in just a few minutes, okay? Okay, why? Liyoto haposeka yotemer for sembalam, because he's the most famous rabbinic decider, whatever it is. V'chazarti bi mipnei she'enu mevi al asvara achat. But I decided not to write it based on the Rambam. Why? Because the Rambam only brings one opinion. He tells you what the law is. But the Rambam doesn't bring the debates in the Talmud. He doesn't bring the different opinions and the different commentators. I would have to write so much if I base it on the Rambam. So it's not really a good starting point. And therefore I decided to base my work from a stylistic standpoint and a structural standpoint on a work called the Arba'a Turim. Who is this written by? Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Harosh. Rabbeinu Jacob, the son of the Rosh. Because he includes a little bit more of the opinions. Okay? Let's go on. Okay? And we're gonna go back to the history here. Who's the Rambam? What's the Rosh? What's this book, the Torah? V'ze mishpat ha-sefer u-ma-sehu. L'va'er hadin shekatav bal ha-turim. Im hu Mishnah, o Braita, o Tosefta, o Mirma b'Tamud b'Bavli, o Yerushalmi, o B'Sifra, o Sifrei l'Mechilta, im hu Skam, o im hu Machloka, Tanaim, o Marim. And he says, I'm going to tell you everything. I'm going to tell you the Talmudic sources, the Midrashic sources, the Yerushalmi, the Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud. I'll share with you that as well. And I'm going to tell you whether there are debates, etc. Okay, Nimtza, next paragraph. Shemi sheyes sefer ze lefanav, yu sidrim lefanav divrei Talmud. And therefore, anyone who has my book, the Beit Yosef, is going to have the following list of books in his hand. He's going to have the Talmud and Perush Rashi, the commentary of Rashi, the Tosfot. We're going to talk about the Tosfot in just a second. They are the ancestors of Rashi from Germany. The Ran, Piskei Harith, the Rosh, the Mordechai, the Rambam, the Hegyotav, the Magin Mishnah, Rabbeinu Yerucham, Sefer Truma, Shibulei Aleket, Rokeach, Sharidura, Sefer Atashbeitz, these are all the famous works of the medieval Jewish scholars. You're going to have access to all of these if you study the Beit Yosef. Okay? That's a pretty helpful tool. Okay? Now let's go on. The Alabidati. But now the question is, so he has 30 different works to work from. How is he going to decide who the halakha follows? Who's he going to decide based on? 30 works doesn't make it any easier to know what you need to do practically. Mm-hmm. How are you going to decide what the halacha is? V'ala b'dati, she'achar kol ha-dvarim efsok halacha v'achriya ben ha-svarot, gizeu ha-tachlit liot lanu, torat achad u-mishpat achad. V'ra'iti she'im banu lomar she'nachriya din ben ha-poskim b'ta'anot u-ra'yot tamudiyot v'nei ha-tosafot v'chidushi ha-ramban v'rashpa ran zal. So what does he say here? He says, all these rabbis are arguing about all these different debates in the Talmud. He says, who am I to continue their debates? He says, I'm not going to continue their debates. I'm going to organize their debates. Whatever they debated about how to read the Talmud, mm-hmm. I'm going to leave that aside, and I'm going to choose from them. Basically, he's saying, the period of interpretation of the Talmud has sort of come to an end. Whatever the Rishonim have come up with in terms mm-hmm. of interpreting the Talmud, if there are four ways to read a particular passage, that's it. So there are four ways. He's going to choose between them. He's not going to decide who's right or who's wrong. He's just going to decide practically who that halacha is right. Okay. So in terms of theoretical options for reading the Talmud, those have already been determined by these previous medieval scholars from the year 1000 all the way to the 1500s. Okay. And therefore he said, "Lachen hiskamti." Next paragraph. Bedati ki liot shloshet amudei ha-hora'a asher habayit beit Yisrael nishan aleihem b'horotehem halohim ha-harif v'harambam v'harosh zal amarti elibi shebemakom sheshnayim mehem maskimim l'dat echad nifsok halacha kemotam. He says there are three, out of all these opinions, there are three that are the greatest. Who are the greatest? The Rif, the Rambam, and the Rosh. And he's going to pick, we're going to go through it in just a second, and we're going to pick the best of the three, two out of three, and that's how we're going to determine the halacha. Okay, now let's take a step back and figure out what's going on here. Let's take a step back for a second, okay? So let's go to the first page, because we have a map here in which I share with you the geographic locations and times when all these people lived. And we're going to make a little bit more sense of this. Okay, so let's just go back in history. The Talmud is written when? Anybody know when the Talmud is written? When is it composed?
170.
Okay, well, it starts being written about 200 CE, and it's finished in 600 CE. 200 to 600 CE. That's the Babylonian Talmud. And there's a corresponding Jerusalem Talmud, which is written in Israel. And there are all these debates and opinions. Does the Talmud resolve any of the conflicts? Not really. The Talmud is an open book. Doesn't really tell us who's right and who's wrong. Rav, Shmuel, Abaye, Rava. So once in a while, very rarely. It remains an open discussion. Now, you then move on to the period of the Geonim. The Geonic scholars are the rabbis who continue after the writing of the Talmud in Babel and Babylonia. Okay, and they try to figure out, based on the Talmud, how we follow the halacha, what we do practically. Okay? And then we get to the time of the Rishonim. Okay? And the Rishonim are living primarily in which area? The Rishonim are called the first ones, the first scholars. Where do the Rishonim live? Anyone know where they live? They live in two primary locations. What are those two primary locations? Anybody know?
I mean, the Rambam is a Rishon.
The Rambam is a Rishon. Where is he from?
Spain.
Sfarad. And you have?
France.
And you have France. Okay? And the Spanish and French rabbis are going to take the study of Talmud to a new level. But before we get to the Rishonim, the Spanish and the French, let's just first get a better understanding of what the Gaonic tradition, the Gaonic tradition is and what the Gaonim were doing. So let's look at the map here. Okay? Because, you see everyone, this is a map of North Africa, the Middle East on the right side, and Europe on the top. Now, the Gaonim, they lived in a place called Babylon, which is, where is that today, Babylon?
Iraq.
Iraq. Okay, lived in what's today Iraq. And their influence spread throughout the Middle East and North Africa. Okay? Now, the last of the Gaonic rabbis, the greatest, okay, so the last of the Gaonic rabbis is a person, I mean, he's considered one of the Gaonim, basically the last person is somebody called the Rif. Rav Yitzchak Alfazi. Look to the left. Where does Rav Yitzchak Alfazi live? Where does he live?
Rabat.
Morocco.
Morocco. Where in Morocco?
Fez.
Mm-hmm. Alfazi. Fez.
Oh.
So he lives in Fez. And he lives from 1013 to 1103. Okay?
He's the last of the Geonim?
He's the last of the Geonim. And also, one could argue, he really exemplifies the Gaonic model of study. And we're going to talk about what that is in just a second. He lived from 1013 to 1103, very long life for this period in time. Mm-hmm. He was born in Tunisia, in Karouan. He studied there under the guidance of Rav Nissim Gaon and Rabbeinu Hananel, who are two other Gaonim. He spends 10 years writing a book called Sefer Halachot, which we'll see in just a second. 1045, he moves to Fez, and he builds a yeshiva. And he's there for many, many years, until 1089, he's there for 40 years. 1089, he's forced to leave Fez, and he moves northward to Spain. And he becomes the Rosh Yeshiva in a place called Lucena. Okay? Lucena. His most famous Talmud is a person by the name of, anybody know? Rav Yosef ibn Migash. Rav Yosef ibn Migash had a Talmud by the name of Rav Maimon. And Rav Maimon had a son by the name of the Rambam. The Rambam. Okay? So there's a direct connection between the Rif and the Rambam. Now, what is the Sefer HaHalachot? This is a very important work in the history of Halacha. Why? Because you have a Talmud. Do you have a set of Talmud here?
I don't.
Oh, you don't. Okay, no worries. Actually, that is a Talmud on top there.
I have some.
Okay. So the Talmud, again, doesn't resolve any of the debates. And if I want to find the law in the Talmud, I need to know basically all 2,700 pages of the Talmud, because otherwise I have no idea where to look. Is there an index book for the Talmud? No. Is there a... none of this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have... I mean, it doesn't... The Talmud doesn't resolve anything. You see, a page of a Talmud is about as dense as any page that you could find. Page of the Talmud, right? Okay, you see the work that Artko put in just to explain the Talmud, right? Now, what he does is as follows. He's the first one to write a comprehensive code of the Talmud. What you have to do practically. Now, he doesn't rewrite the Talmud. He doesn't reorganize it. He doesn't take it and reorganize it and redraft it and restructure it. What he does is he takes the same format of the Talmud and he just quotes the opinions that we follow and he deletes the opinions that we don't follow. So he takes the Talmud and he contracts it a little bit. You understand that? And this came to be known in some circles, the Talmud Katan. In fact, some people would study the Rif, his Sefer Halachot, without studying the Talmud, because he takes out some of the debates, and it's a little bit less confusing, the Rav Yitzchak Alfasi's work. It quotes the part of the Gemara in the language of the Gemara that we follow. And if you look at the page of the Talmud, of the Rif, it looks exactly like the Talmud. Because it really is the Talmud, just with a few deletions. Okay? Now, there's another difference. He doesn't quote any of the Talmud tractates that are not practical.
You know, Zayim.
Yeah, what about things that have to do with, you know, planting in the land of Israel or sacrifices? He doesn't deal with that stuff. Why? Because it's not practical. He only deals with practical halacha. Mm-hmm. And we're going to see an example of the Rif. We're actually going to go through a sugya. We're going to start with the Gemara and then the Rif, and we're going to see exactly what he does. Okay? So that's what the Rif does. That's Rav Yitzchak Alfasi. And he is part of the Gaonic tradition. What does it mean that he's part of the Gaonic tradition? This is a very key point. When you have two sources which contradict each other, okay? One source says that 2 plus 2 equals 4. The other source says that 2 plus 2 equals 5. Okay? The Gaonim would say, well, one source is wrong, the other source is right. And this is the piece of the Talmud that we follow. We follow 2 plus 2 equals 4. Whereas another way of studying the Talmud is to say, wait a second, this source says 2 plus 2 equals 4. That's true in this case. Whereas 2 plus 2 equals 5 is true in another case. They're both correct. You just have to figure out when this is true and when that is true. Let me give a better example than 2 plus 2 equals 4 and 5. One Gemara says that Prime Grill is the best kosher restaurant in New York City. And the other...
I had lunch today in Reserve Casa.
Okay. The other Gemara says that the best restaurant in New York City is...
La Marais.
Okay. We have this debate. Who's correct? The Gaonim would say, well, one of them is correct and the other one is wrong. What's correct? Well, obviously, Prime Grill is the better one. La Marais, sorry, it's just not as good. It's wrong, okay? And they will... So you see how this clarifies the Talmud? It makes it a little bit simpler. We're going to see another method, though, by the Balei Tosafot. The Balei Tosafot were rabbis who lived following Rashi. They were the ancestors of Rashi. They lived for 300 years around, from 200 to 300 years, from the 1100s to the 1350s. and they're in a place in Germany and France, Tsarfatim, and the Germans. And they would say, how would they resolve this debate between Lamarey and Prime Grill? What would they say? They would say, for the Americans, Prime Grill is the best place to go. Because Americans have a specific palate, and they're used to specific types of food. And for the Americans, the bigger the steak, the more expensive, that for them tastes better. But for the French, Lamarey is the best restaurant. Why? Because it brings them back to what the cuisine that they know back in Paris, right? And it's what they grew up with in their mother's home. And so for the French, Lamarey is a better steakhouse. Do you understand how what we've done here is that we've decided that both of them are correct? One's correct for one group of people, one's correct for another group of people. You understand that distinction? So the Geonim are saying one's wrong, one's right. Very simple. Lamarey or Prime Grill, it's one or the other. The Baalei Tosafot introduce what's called the dialectical method. Right. And the dialectical method seeks to prove that no, both sources could be correct. One is talking about case A, the other one's talking about case B. Now we could give a different explanation for why Lamarey and Prime Grill are better or worse than each other. Well, the staff is better at Prime Grill, the service is better there. Lamarey, the service is not as good, and well, it's quite loud. If you want to sit in the restaurant, Prime Grill, you get a little bit more romantic. It's better, ambiance, right? And whereas Lamarey is more stuffy, you're sitting next to all these Jews, and they're all yapping in your face, and you can't even hear the person sitting across from you, right? That's another way of distinguishing it. But then we could distinguish it by location. Well, Lamarey is better. Why is Lamarey better? Because if I go to a Broadway show, I could go straight to Lamarey, and it's open at 11 o'clock at night after my show. If I want to go to Prime Grill, I got to go downtown, right? They moved to the east side, to some hotel on the east side.
The three Prime Grills, but the main one's on 56 or 55.
So I have to walk farther from Broadway to get there. There are many ways to parse the difference between Prime Grill and Lamarey. And the Baalei Tosafot come up with different explanations for these things. But you see how there's a dialectical method of the Baalei Tosafot and the Gaonic method of, you know, of removing the casuistry, removing the complication of the Gemara. Yeah.
I was just going to say that they kind of come up with these reasons that are kind of not inherently in the text in any way, shape, or form.
Okay, so right? That's the...
They'll come up with why they'll... Right, it'll say this restaurant is better and this restaurant is better, but it doesn't actually indicate anywhere in the text, like, oh, it's based on if you're French or American and these are the reasons why, etc. Tosafot reads that in.
So that is one of the challenges of that method.
You mean it's implicit in the way that they discuss it?
Sometimes very implicit.
Sometimes speculative. Uh-huh. Right. Sometimes it's a little bit, you know, and that's what you have to study. That's what you study. How did the Baalei Tosafot come to their conclusions? Okay, so let's just look at this map again. So Rav Yitzchak Alfasi's in Morocco, in Fez, okay, from 1013 to 1103, and then he ends up moving to Spain. Okay, now the Baalei Tosafot, who we just focused on, they're in a place called, they're in Germany and France, further up north. Okay, and they're developing their own method of study. And then we get to, so that's the Rif. Okay, everyone understand who the Rif was and why he was important? Good. Let's move on to the Rambam. The Rambam is going to revolutionize the study of Talmud, okay, in a very significant way. Just like the Rif revolutionized thing by coming up with the first code that was you could follow somewhat practically, even though we didn't reorganize things, the Rambam's going to take it to the next level. The Rambam is also part of the Gaonic tradition. So he's going to do the same thing as the Rif in terms of choosing between one sugya, between Lamarey and Prime Grill. He's going to choose one of them correct. Yeah, he continues the Gaonic tradition, but he's already one of the Rishonim. But what the Rambam does is unique. Instead of using the structure of the Talmud, which is, you know, endless and dense and disorganized, the Rambam reorganizes all of halakha thematically into different sections, into different topics. He takes the whole thing and rewrites it in a totally different way. I mean, it is a masterpiece what he does. It took him 10 years, staying up day and night to write this work. What is his work called?
The Mishneh Torah.
Okay? The Mishneh Torah. So he writes the Mishneh Torah, and where is the Rambam? The Rambam is in Cordoba, but then he has to flee Cordoba because of the Almohad invasion, and he moves then to Cairo. So you see I have two arrows for the Rambam, Cordoba and Cairo. You guys see the two lines going to the Rambam on the left?
Yep.
Good. Now the Rambam is also different than the Rif in another way. Because the Rambam, so the Rambam basically gives you the all of halakha in one work. And it's not just practical halakha. The Rambam writes about halakha for eternity. The laws of sacrifices, the laws of vows, the laws of purity and impurity, the laws of zra'im, of harvesting and planting in the land of Israel. Everything. Ethical, you know, philosophy and law. He combines these things. But the Rambam's Mishneh Torah is problematic. Why is the Rambam's Mishneh Torah challenging? Because he doesn't quote his sources. So you have the Rambam. You have this amazing work.
So you have to know it all.
But you still have to know where he's getting his sources from. Mm-hmm. At least with the Rif, because the Rif modeled it after the structure of the Talmud, so you just look at where it is in the Talmud. Okay? You still have to find where it is in the Rif.
Is it orthographically the same as in the Talmud? The same columns and breaks? So like if you say, you know, something 58A...
No, it's broken up differently. It's a good question, but broken up a little bit differently. Yeah, it's different.
And so you wrote it like off his own mind?
The Rambam? Well, no, he studied, you know, stuff for 10 years, but then he rewrites everything. He reorganizes everything. Okay, so he redoes it all. And that's why the Mishneh Torah is such a pleasant work to read, because it's organized. The Talmud, you take one step forward and five steps backwards, and then three steps forward, and you're moving around, and it's going on tangents, and this discussion, that. The Mishneh Torah is perfectly organized in 14 sections and broken up into 83 subtopics, and there are 983 chapters, and it's beautiful. You could study, you could learn, and it's written in Mishnaic Hebrew. It's written in easier Hebrew. The Talmud's in Aramaic. Who knows Aramaic?
Right.
He writes this in Hebrew. Okay, because he basically sees himself as rewriting the oral law, which is the Mishnah, which was in Hebrew. So he writes this in Hebrew. Okay, this is the Mishneh Torah. You could pass it around. You'll see the topic at the top, and you know, the subdivisions, etc. Yeah.
Was it deliberate to not, you know, do use citations?
Yes, it was deliberate because it was so, you know, he wanted to make it accessible to all people.
Right.
And if you give citations, then it becomes a piece of research. It becomes academic, and it's not accessible. But at the same time, and it's a very good question, he regrets that he did this. At the end of his life, he tries to find all the sources, to write down all the sources for his stuff, and he can't even remember everything. His memory is failing him at the end of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And the next 800 years since the Rambam wrote this work, Maimonidean scholarship is based on figuring out the sources of the Rambam. There are 300 books written on the Mishneh Torah, trying to find it. Actually, some of them are in the book right there. You'll see all these commentaries on the side. Mm-hmm. They locate the Rambam sources. Rav Nachum Rabinovich, my Rosh Yeshiva from Malei Adumim, he has 18 books on the Rambam, locating all of the Rambam sources.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Is it that the sources aren't clear? It's more like how he didn't come to his conclusion.
Yeah, exactly.
Most of the time it's clear which sukkah he's relying on.
Yeah, exactly. But how he combines. Sometimes he'll be working, he'll be drawing from 10 different sukkiot,
right,
and fusing them into one and rewriting it and codifying it. Can imagine that, you know, it takes to break that apart, to figure out how he came to his conclusion when he doesn't tell you, is it takes a lot of time. Okay? So this is Rav Kapach wrote extensively in the Rambam, the Sfaradibuk Sfaradi Rabbi. Many Rabbanim have written extensively on the Mishneh Torah. There are many commentaries on the Mishneh Torah. So that is the Rambam. And he's in Cordoba in Cairo, 1138 to 1204. But then there is the third pillar of the Beit Yosef. And the third pillar of the Beit Yosef, so we have the Sefer Halachot of the Rif, we have the Rambam, and now we move on to a book called the Piskei Harosh. And everyone see this on the top left, Piskei Harosh, Rabbeinu Asher. Has anyone here ever heard of Rabbeinu Asher?
Nope.
Who is Rabbeinu Asher? Okay, Rabbeinu Asher is one of the Baalei Tosafot. He's one of the German, Franco-German rabbis. He lives from 1250 to 1327. And he is the student of the great Rabbi Maharam Mirutenberg. Okay, Maharam Mirutenberg. Will anyone know what happened to him at the end of his life? This is a famous story. Maharam Mirutenberg lived in a place called Worms, right? Yes. This is also where Rashi was from, in northern France. He was taken captive by the Christian...
is that how he ended
Christian
up in
government.
Toledo?
Yes, exactly. He was taken captive. Maharam was taken captive, and they wanted they asked for a massive ransom for him. And the Rush, his Talmud, Rabbeinu Asher was his Talmud, gathered up the money for it, and Maharam told him, I don't want you to do this. I will stay in jail. Maharam stays in jail, and he dies in jail 10 years later.
Oh, okay.
He's the greatest, you know, rabbinic leader in his region, Maharam Mirutenberg, and he dies in jail, and his student, the Rush, Rabbeinu Asher, flees to Toledo.
What was his rationale for rejecting the...
It was too much money. It would have depleted the resources of the Jewish community. Okay, it would have impoverished the community.
Why did they put him in jail?
Because they were anti-Semites, that's why.
Okay.
You know,
but they didn't say something specific.
No, there was no basis for it. So you have the Rush. He walks into Toledo. And what is Toledo? Toledo is, I mean, now it was already under the Christians, but Toledo is the heartland of Sephardic culture.
Yep.
Okay? You have this Ashkenazi rabbi. He's speaking Yiddish. He wears, I don't know, a bekesha. He has this thick German accent. He doesn't know the language. He's not in style, right? And he walks into the middle of Spain. Okay? And he's a totally different perspective. He's not interested in philosophy like the Sephardim were. Mm-hmm. And he's not as open-minded, if you will. But he is a brilliant Talmudic scholar. And he becomes a judge and a rabbi and a Rosh Yeshiva in Toledo. And he becomes incredibly accepted and welcomed. And some of his halachot even are accepted amongst the Sfaradim.
This is Yaakov.
This is Rabbeinu Asher. Rabbeinu Asher.
Oh, that's the other one.
Rabbeinu Asher. Okay?
It's the Rosh. Right?
This is the Rosh. And he writes a work called Piskei HaRosh, in which he takes some of the writings of the Sfaradim and some of the writings of the Ashkenazim, and he combines them, and he writes a commentary on the Talmud. Okay? And that's called Piskei HaRosh. And then he gives you, you know, the halakha is like this or like that. But he's one of the Balei Tosafot. He is German, he's Ashkenazi. Now,
masters of what? Balei Tosafot?
Oh, Balei Tosafot. Oh, I mean the masters of additions, because they added on to the commentaries of Rashi.
Oh, okay.
They're adding on to in their dialectical method. Okay, now,
you have Rabbeinu Asher?
Yeah, that's Rabbeinu Asher. That's what I'm talking about,
Rabbeinu
Asher.
Asher?
Okay, yes, I'm going to get there in just a second. Yeah, I'm going to get there in just a second. So, by the way, some of the Moroccans have customs that are connected to the Rush. Okay? The Moroccans are sometimes accused by their Sfaradim of having Ashkenazi minhagim. Why? Because some of the customs of the Rush trickle down into Morocco. Okay? And that's why you have this whole, you know, that conflict, okay?
You have now, the Moroccan last name, Ben Arosh.
Ben Arosh, okay, very good. Okay, now, the Rush has a son by the name of Rav Yaakov Ben Asher. Rav Yaakov Ben Asher. And he writes a halacha book called the Arba'a Turim. What does the Arba'a Turim mean? What does that mean, Arba'a Turim? It means the four columns. What is the four columns referring to? It's the four columns on the breastplate of the foot of the Kohen Gadol with the different stones of the Shvatim. Three times four, right? Four, okay? Arba'at Turim. It's in the Chumash. And why is it called the Arba'at Turim? Because there are four columns, four sections in his commentary. Okay? So he writes another halachic book called the Arba'at Turim. Now, the Arba'at Turim is not based on 14 different categories like the Rambam. It's based on four. And those four categories are called, anybody know what they're called? The one's called Orachaim, which is about practical daily halacha. There's Yoredea, which is ritualistic law. There's Even HaEzer, which is personal status, women's issues, marriage, etc. And then there's a Choshen Mishpat, which is tort law and monetary law and civil law. Exactly. Okay? So he breaks it into four sections. Now, Why does this all matter? And the Arba Turim becomes a popular, practical halachic book that, you know, contains a bunch of the different opinions of each of the Sfaradim and the Ashkenazim. Okay? Now, the Beit Yosef is going to do the following. Let's go back to his introduction, and now we really know what the Beit Yosef is doing. The Beit Yosef is saying, I'm going to include all the commentaries from all the rabbis from the time of the Talmud all the way through the 1500s. But, in terms of Psak Halacha, I'm going to follow based on the following three pillars of Halacha. The Rambam, the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rush. So let's go back to the paragraph, Lachen Hiskamti. V'lachen Hiskamti, bedati, ki liyot shaloshet amudei ha-hora'a asher ha-bayit beit Yisrael nishan aleihem, because the house of Israel depends on these three pillars. Okay? Can a house stand without at least three pillars, right? Chair needs at least three pillars to stand. Okay? Bohoroteim alohei maharith ramam harosh. Okay? And these are the rift, the ramam, and the rush. Amarti elibi shebamakom sheshnaim mehem askim medat achat nifso kalacha kimotam. I said to myself, I'm going to pick two out of three. Majority wins. When any two of the three agree on something, I'm going to follow that opinion. If the Rambam and the Rif agree, he's going to follow them. If the Rosh and the Rambam agree, he'll follow them. If the Rif and the Rosh agree, he'll follow them. And that's how he's going to determine halacha.
But it's biased toward the Sfaradim.
Ah, nachon. It's biased towards the Sfaradim. Why is it biased toward the Sfaradim? First of all, the Rambam and the Rif are both Sfaradim. It's also biased to them because they're part of the same tradition. Remember, the Rambam, Rimigash, Rav Maimon and the Rambam, they're part of the same halachic tradition. So that's true. The Shulchan Aruch is very often going to follow the Shita of the Rambam. And this is going to explain later on, sorry, the Beit Yosef, this is going to explain later on why the Ashkenazim are not going to be so happy with the Beit Yosef or the Shulchan Aruch. Now, we haven't even gotten to the Shulchan Aruch. We have no idea what the Shulchan Aruch is. We're talking about an encyclopedic work called the Beit Yosef. At some point in time, this guy's going to write another work called the Shulchan Aruch, but we have not gotten there yet. That's next week. Okay? That suspends for next week. But let's go on here. Okay? But he says, though, in the next paragraph, Umakom she'achad min ha-gimel ha-amudim ha-nizkrim lo gila da'ato b'din, ha-hu, va-sheni, va-sheni ha-amudim ha-nizkrim chokim ha-davar, hine ha-ramban, va-rashba, va-ran. He says, if, you know, in a case where all three of these rabbis don't say something about something, so if two of them do, okay, then I'll figure in the other Rishonim, the Ramban, and the Rashban, the Ran, and the Mordechai, all these other Rishonim, who he's not following directly, like the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rush. Okay? And then let's go on to the bold face lines at the bottom. Okay? The Toelet Sefer Zela Chachamim Mevora. This is the long, short path. Long, short path means that it starts long, but it's really going to get you somewhere quicker than the short, long path, right? Which you think is a shortcut, but it's not. Why? This work is going to give you everything. It's all going to be in front of you. Al-Kain, and now we understand the title of the work. Al-Kain Kerativ Beit Yosef. This is why I've called it Beit Yosef. Ki kishem shemi Beit Yosef hayu nizonim akol mazon haguf, kach yu nizonim zefer ze mazon hanefesh. Just like Joseph, the ruler in Egypt, sustained all of the Egyptians and the Jewish people during the famine. He sustained them physically. This work is going to sustain the Jewish people spiritually. Yeah. And furthermore, this is I find this so beautiful. Avod tam sheni ki zechel ki mikol amali v'hu beiti ba'olam hazeh uva'olam haba. This is my portion. This is my work in life. This is my life's work. It is my home. In my home in this world and the next world.
Okay? A mission.
This is my mission, my life mission. This is my home. This is my life's work. Writing the Beit Yosef. And indeed, it takes him 30 years to write the Beit Yosef. So that's all for history, and now we understand what this work is, the Beit Yosef. But we only know it in theory because we haven't studied it yet. And right now, we're going to study the Beit Yosef. So, first of all, let me show you. Before we do that, I want you to, let's do some show and tell. We have a book called The Arba'a Turim HaShalem. And who wrote this? Who wrote the Arba'a Turim?
Yeah,
written by Rav Yaakov Ben Asher. Okay. And if we look at this work here, you know, let me give you copies for a second. Okay, let me give you guys all copies of this.
Is
we're not going to.
Is there a name for this kind of typography?
What do you mean typography?
Well, you know, we have Rashi script.
Oh, well, some of this is Rashi script, as we'll see. Quite a bit of this is Rashi script.
You know, yeah. I noticed that there's like in the Mishneh Torah. There's one kind of type in the middle of the page, and then the columns surrounding have a font that's more like it's handwritten.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. This is. I mean, you'll see. Well, we'll see in just a second. You'll see what we have here. Okay. So, this is a page of the tour. What's called the tour Arba'at Turim and the Beit Yosef.
Just a little bit.
Okay. Okay. So, let's look at this for a second. We're actually not going to... Okay. Okay. We're going to... I'm just doing this right now for show and tell, but we're going to come back to this in a little bit more next week. You have in the middle the Torah. You see that in the middle? That's the book, the Arba'at Turim. That's right in the middle. That's the block in the middle. Mm-hmm. On the right side, you have the Beit Yosef. The Beit Yosef, this is Rav Yosef Kaira. Mm-hmm. And now there's someone else who wrote another work called the Bayit Chadash. That's Rav Yoel Sirkis. Okay, he was Ashkenazi. It's called Bayit Chadash. It was written in the 16th century, whatever it is.
But that's what it means, new house? Or
yeah, new house, okay? So this, what we're going to be studying a little bit is the Beit Yosef. You see that the Beit Yosef, and if you go to the next page, you'll see it's pretty extensive. You see how the tour is pretty small, right? The Beit Yosef is extensive, it's really long. And
I'm
in fact...
I'm really confused.
Okay, yeah. So let's go back to it.
So the four Turim, it was written by Yaakov Ben Asher. No, by...
Yaakov Ben Asher. Yeah.
And that's what he wrote?
In the middle.
This little thing?
Uh-huh. In the middle, yeah.
So the whole thing, who wrote the whole thing?
Oh, well, there are commentaries. Look at the top right. You see what's the name there?
Beit Yosef.
That's Beit Yosef. That's Rav Yosef Kairo's work, the Beit Yosef.
Okay.
That's what we're studying tonight, the Beit Yosef. And if you go to the next page also, you'll see the Beit Yosef on the next page also, top left.
Okay, but you said there was more things, there were several things on this page.
Yeah, there are other commentaries.
Okay.
The primary one here, though, is the Beit Yosef. We're going to study a little bit more of them in the next few weeks. This is the whole work. You know how many there are of these, of the whole thing?
There
are like, 15 or 18 of these. Why are there so many? Because the Beit Yosef is really long. It's like the Encyclopedia Judaica.
So who wrote Orea Chaim?
So Orea Chaim is, remember, he broke it up into four sections. So Orea Chaim is the laws that deal with practical life, daily life. Prayers, tefillah, kriyat shema, saying the shema, blessings, daily blessings, how we eat food, all those things. That's Orea Chaim. Tzadi Dalet is the name of the chapter. Hilchot tefillah, the laws of prayer. Okay, that's what that is. Okay? And if you want to pass this around just to see, get a glimpse of it inside. Okay? I'll give you a little bit more of a sense of what's happening here. Now, what I want to do here is I want to study a sugya and just show you how the Beit Yosef works. Okay?
What does sugya mean?
Sugya means a topic. Okay? So let's go to page 2 on the source sheet here. Okay, we're putting down the big source sheet. We're just going to look at the smaller source sheet. Okay. Now, the topic here, I chose a random topic, but which I thought was representative of how the Beit Yosef works. Okay? And how he arrives at his decisions and what he writes and what he leaves out. So we're going to study a little topic here. Has anybody here ever been sitting in the middle of Shema? You're sitting... Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, Ve'ahavta Hashem Elokecha. And then what happens?
Somebody say hello.
Your best friend walks into shul. Okay? And what do you want to do? You want to say hi? You want to give him a hug? or an Arshul, you want to give him a kiss on both sides of the cheek, right? What do? Are you supposed to say hi to this person? What if it's a very distinguished person? What if it's your parents? What if it's the rabbi? What if it's some scholar who walks in? Okay, what if it's someone who needs help? Are you allowed to say hi to this person in the middle of the Shema? That's the question in the Gemara. And we're going to see that in the Mishnah, right here, in this box here, there's a debate. Now, I don't want to get too caught up in the details of the debate, but I'll just get the general idea. Okay? So and I put a little chart on the next page, which we'll look at in just a second. So there are two different times when you can get interrupted in the Shema. It could be between the chapters of the Shema, or it could be in the middle of each chapter. Now, how many chapters are there in the Shema? There are three. So it could be, you could get, you know, someone could interrupt you in the middle of the first paragraph. Someone can interrupt you between the first and the second paragraph. And we see that there's a ruling here. Biprakim. Okay, and you could read in the English if you like. Well, in the breaks, okay? In English, it starts in the fifth line. Biprakim, if you're in between chapters, shoel mipnei hakavod u'meishiv. Okay? If someone, out of honor, you can respond to somebody. You could ask, how are you doing, and respond. Uve'emtza, but in the middle of the paragraph, shoel mipnei yir, you could only ask or respond if you're scared, if there's fear, yir'ah. We'll have to see what that is in just a second. Fear. That's the first opinion. That's Divrei Rabbi Meir. Whereas Rabbi Yehuda says, Be'emtza shoel mipnei yira, in the middle you could ask because of yira, and meishiv mipnei hakavod, an answer out of honor. And in between the chapters, shoel mipnei hakavod, you could ask someone else out of honor, and you could answer any person. There are different opinions here about answering, what context, what situation. That's the main idea. Okay, you don't need to get the exact opinions, but that's the general idea. Okay, now let's go to the next page. And you see that the chart there sort of captures their two opinions. Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Prakim, Be'emtza. Okay? Now, if you go to the Rif, let's go to the Rif. Okay? The Rif, Rabbi Yitzchak Alfazi, basically what he does is he just quotes the part of the Gemara that's practically relevant. So he quotes, if you'll notice in the second line, he quotes Divrei Rabbi Meir. And then he quotes in the next line, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Be'emtza Shomim Ibn Yir, Amesh Ibn Yakavud, Rakim Shomim Ibn Yakavud, Amesh Ibn Shalom Chol Adam. And then he adds in two words. What does he say? V'chein Hilchata. This is the law. So the Rif, does he reorganize this? Does he change anything? No. He just adds in two words. We follow the second opinion. We follow Rabbi Yehuda. You see how he's not reorganizing anything, but he's just telling you who we follow. Follow this opinion as opposed to the second opinion. Does he give you his logic? No. Does he give you a rationale? An extensive explanation? No. He just tells you what we do. Okay? That's the Rif. The Rambam, okay, let's go to the next piece. The Rambam, okay, now we're going to have a little bit of debate of what does it mean to answer and to respond because of kavod and yirah. What is kavod and yirah? What do you think that means? Kavod and yirah. What's yirah mean generally?
Fear.
Fear. And what's kavod?
Honor.
So what would be an example of honor?
The king walks in.
If the king walks in. The king. King of Morocco walks into our shul. So maybe that's yira. That's interesting. What would be an example of yira?
The police.
The police walking. Or the Cossacks walking, right? Or the German censor.
The Gestapo, yeah.
Okay, walks in. Or the Gestapo. Well, yeah, okay. You run for your life. But yeah, you also say hello first, okay? So that's the... So now we're going to have a debate about what does it mean to answer and respond based on yira and kavod. So the Rambam tells us, "Hayakore be'emza parasha, eino posek matchil lishol ela b'shalom." So the Rambam, that's the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda. He quotes the same opinion. But notice, does Rambam quote the debate here? There's no debate. He just quotes Rabbi Yehuda. Does he use the language of the Talmud? No, he actually changes it a little bit into Mishnaya Kibru. Okay, so he follows Rabbi Yehuda just like the Rif, because he's in the same tradition as the Rif. But he quotes, but he doesn't tell you who he's following. Okay? And now he explains in the bold-faced words what yarei and what yira and what kavod are. Mi shehu mit yarei mimenu kigon melech o anas Onas or Anas Vikayotze Bahen. What is Yarei? What is Yir'a? If the king walks in. If the governor, this, you know, whatever it is, the of the region walks in and you're very scared of him. Oh, Anas, I'm not sure what or someone who coerced, I don't know who that is exactly, or Anas or Vikayotze Bahen. Is that a person?
No, if you're... Oh, keep on.
It sounds like it's a noun, like describing a particular person. Okay, so that's what Yira is. Fear of the king or some governor or whatever it is. And what is kavod? That you stand up for your parents or for your rabbi. That's kavod. Okay? Now let's look at... So that was the Rif and the Rambam. You see how the Rambam follows the Rif? That they follow Rabbi Yehuda? You see that? They follow the second opinion, Rabbi Yehuda, that you can answer in the middle. You can answer because of Yira. Okay, that he follows that opinion, but then Rambam explains what it is because the Rif doesn't explain. Let's now go to the Rosh. The Rosh.
Which paragraph are
we in? We're in the next. You see the bold face, we're in the third source. Rosh. Masachah Brachot paragraph.
Okay. Yep.
Okay. The Rosh is going to, he's going to quote the sources in the beginning of the Mishnah, Matanitin, Bibrakim, Shomli. Okay, he quotes the two opinions, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda. See, he quotes his two opinions. And then he quotes a new source, the Yerushalmi. He quotes the Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi says, Ad kadun be'emtza parsha, afilu be'emtza pasuk. Not only can you interrupt the middle of a parsha, the middle of a section, even in the middle of a verse itself. Okay, so he brings in this new source here, the Yerushalmi. Okay? And then he goes into some explanation about Mipnei Hayira. Perish Rashi, Adam Shu Mitere Shema Yahargenu. Rashi says that a person's scared that he's going to get killed. That's what Yira is, that you're scared you're going to get killed. Velo Nihirali, the Rosh says, that doesn't make sense to me. Pshita She'en Lecha Devar She'omei Mipnei Pikuach Nefesh. Of course, if some you're going to die, you're allowed to answer. If someone ever threatens you, you're allowed to violate halacha. Of course, what this halacha needs to teach us that you could answer, you could respond to someone in the middle of Shema if you're in danger? Of course you could answer if you're in danger. What are you, a fool? Of course you can. So what does Yira then need to be referring to? Rather, Yira is referring to Ishimova Aviv Tirao. It's referring to your parents. That's what Yira is. Yira is your parents because you're supposed to fear your parents. So then what's Kavod? Okay, so the Kavod then he's going to have to give a different explanation of Kavod. Okay, and then we have another commentator, the Rashba. The Rashba says, "What's kavod?" If you look in the boldface words, kavod, misha gadol mimenu bechokhma. It's someone who's greater than you in wisdom. If anybody walks in greater than you in wisdom, these are the different rishonim, and we see some of their methods. Now let's move to the next page, and we'll see the tour and the Beit Yosef inside. Okay, and this is where. Okay, let's go to the tour and the Beit Yosef. So this is the Torah. This is the work, okay, that's in the middle here, the Torah. And the Torah is going to say, Bein haprakim shoel b'shalom adam b'shalom adam nechban mipnei kvodo u'meishiv shalom lekol adam u'v'emtza afilu b'emtza pasuk shalom mipnei ha'yira u'meishiv mipnei ha'kavod u'perish rashi mipnei ha'yira adam she'erem yinu shema yargenu v'chen katav ha'ramam zal anas. So does he quote the whole Gemara here, the whole debate? Does he quote the two opinions? No. He just gives you the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda without telling you that it's Rabbi Yehuda. And then he quotes the debate between Rashi and Rashi. Rashi says that what's Yira, what's fear? That you're going to get hurt. And that's the same opinion of the Rambam. Chen katav Rambam. So you see, this is Rabbi Yaakov ben Asher quoting the Ashkenazi source, the Rashi, and also the Rambam. But then he quotes his father, V'lo nihira la'aduni avizal. This doesn't make sense according to my father. Who's his father? The Rosh, which we just saw inside. This doesn't make sense. The Hamilta de Pshita She'en Lecha Davar She'omeid Bifnei Pikuach Nefesh. It's clear that, of course, in a case of danger, you could answer, you could say hi. Upire Shul Mipnei HaYira Hainu Yirat Aviv or Abo. And therefore, what does Yira mean? If your father or your parent or your rabbi walks in, you're supposed to have fear of them. Okay? So you see how Rabbeinu Asher, he just quotes, the Torah quotes his father, and he quotes different opinions, Rashi and the Rambam. And now let's go to the Beit Yosef. Because the Beit Yosef is going to quote everything that we've had so far, and even more. It's like the collection pool. It collects everything. Okay? He collects everything. So he quotes, we're just going to see this. Okay, he quotes, if you'll notice, he quotes the Gemara. You see the parentheses here, Yud Gimel Amud Aleph, he quotes the whole entire Gemara. He quotes the Yerushalmi in the next paragraph. He quotes the Rush. He quotes, then his own opinion, Nirali. He quotes Rashi. He quotes the Tur, who quotes his father. And then he quotes the Rashba, and he quotes the Rambam at the end. He quotes everything that's been in this debate until now. Okay, and he clarifies some of them. You see how everything, he's bringing to you everything. You almost don't even need the Talmud here. You could just read the Beit Yosef. In fact, many rabbinical students, when they're studying practical halakha, they don't even go back to the Gemara to learn them. You learn the Tur and the Beit Yosef.
When I study for the Smicha.
You study. You could study for the Beit Yosef because it really gives you everything. Okay? And so this is just a sense of the methodology of the Beit Yosef. What he's doing. Now, today, it's very easy to take what he does for granted. Why? Because it's easy to take what he did for granted because we have computers today. And we have all the information, you know, at our fingertips and a mouse and on the computer. They didn't have this then. This is like the first supercomputer of halakha. Okay? Or at least it's like that jump between, you know, I don't know, whatever. You know, it's like that...
Encyclopedia.
It's like jumping from, you know, what was it called? The DS, what was it called, that thing?
DOS,
okay, to Windows. Like, that's what he does. It's like revolutionary.
Or DOS to HyperCore.
Yeah, whatever it is, okay? And so you're working within
It's the Mikhaot Gedolot of the Gemara.
Say again?
It's the Mikhaot Gedolot.
It's exactly. It's the Mikraot Gedolot of the Gemara.
Oral law, and it's still studied today.
This book, many books have fallen out of fashion. Okay, you really could study the Beit Yosef, you know, because you get the Rambam, you get the Rishonim, you get the Rush, you get the Rif, you get all the important points along the way, all in the Beit Yosef. Okay, it's really an amazing, work. Okay, and. And what he did was very revolutionary. To decide halakha based on 2 out of 3 rabbis is a new method of determining halakha. Mm-hmm. Okay? It's a very revolutionary way to determine things. Because it used to be, how would you determine halakha? Well, this is what my father did. This is what my grandfather did. This is what my community does. He says, no. We need to universalize the halakhic system. We need to centralize it. We're taking these 3 great scholars, whatever they do, we're going to follow. Doesn't matter where you are. Doesn't matter whether you're in this location, that location. The entire world should be following this work.
Well,
he's not interested in local custom very much. He actually doesn't value it as much. He even says, if you want to follow local custom, only if you want to be more stringent, but not to be more lenient. Mm-hmm. Okay? So this is a revolution which he's creating here. Yeah, question.
You sort of answered the question I was about to ask. I was going to ask if saying this is what my father did, what my community did, you're really talking Michag and not law. It's behavioral precedent.
Yes, that's right.
Folk ways. Even if
that's right.
I
understand what you're saying. It's a mimetic, tradition.
Yes, right.
Okay, as opposed to a literary or scholarly tradition. Right. That's right. Okay, now.
I mean, it's revolutionary, but it's still based on the idea of the majority rule, which we find in the Torah, So it's not totally...
Yeah.
But those are usually when people are present in the same table.
Exactly.
Not like
exactly.
In space and time.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. But what he's trying to do, and this is the key point, to universalize the halachic system. Instead of there being everyone doing a million different things... and then not being able to find anything, everything is centralized, and everybody should follow this method and this psak halacha of the Beit Yosef. Now, there's going to be someone 500 years later, also with the first name of Yosef, who's going to try to do the exact same thing as his predecessor. And who is that?
Ovadia
Yosef. Okay, sorry, it doesn't have the first name. It's the last name. Maybe that's where I confused you. Rav Ovadia Yosef is going to do the same. He follows the same methodology of the Beit Yosef. He says, let's collect everything in all the Svaradim, whether you're from Tayman, or you're from Morocco, or you're from Iraq, or Syria, or Tunisia, or Jerba. You should follow the same customs. Okay, and he centralizes. Again, it's an act of centralization. Okay, and we're going to see that the halachic pendulum swings from decentralization, everyone writing different words, people following different minagim, to then centralization, and then from centralization, everyone starts to do their own thing again, and then centralization again. It's like a, what's the word I'm looking for? It's like an hourglass, right? Mm-hmm. You understand that, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the process, that the dynamic shifts in halakha, and we're gonna see a little bit more of that, okay, for next week. That's just two more minutes, and then we'll finish up. Okay, let's just look at the Beit Yosef. We're gonna study the Beit Yosef inside. Okay, so this is very exciting. Okay, and we're gonna look a little bit more at this for next week. So I'll just give you, I'll give you an example of how you could almost start with the Torah and the Beit Yosef, and you're good to go. You know, you could learn about a whole subject. So let's look at the bottom line in the Torah. Okay, everyone see the Torah, the Arba Aturim? Bottom line in the middle section. Okay? Let's see what the law is here. Dalad. Everyone see that Dalad? Hayaruchev al hachamor. You're riding on the donkey saddle. And guess what? It's time to pray the mincha. Afternoon services. Mincha. So what do you need to do? Do you need to get off your donkey and pray? Or can you pray while sitting on your donkey? What do you think? What do you think you have to do? If you're on the subway, what do you need to do? If you're in the car, what do you need to do? If you're on the plane, these are all the same, these are derivatives of the same question. Ein sarich leireid ulihipalel. Let's go to the next page. You don't need to get off of the donkey and pray. Afilu im yeshno mi shetofes chamaro. Even if there's somebody who could hold your donkey steady and make sure that it doesn't run away and run after the chickens, right? Ela mipalel derech hilucho. Rather, you could pray as you're sitting on your donkey in the middle of travel. Does that make sense? Everyone understand that halacha? Okay. And then he goes on. V'chein im hayoshev basfina. Also, if you're sitting in a boat. O al gabe karon. Or you're on a carriage. Yoshev umipalel, you can sit and pray. Okay?
Or in the plane.
Or in the plane.
We should
okay.
have that.
So okay.
There's a conflict there.
Okay, so this is the halacha. Now, let's say all you have is the Arba Aturim. All you have is this word called the Arba Aturim. And you want to learn more about this. You want to give a shiur, a class on this. Or you want to know more about this question. What about a plane? What if you can stop for 5 minutes and you'll still be fine? Are you allowed to stop? Do you have to stop? So you have no idea where to look this up. Because you don't know, you don't have an encyclopedic knowledge of the Talmud. So what do? You go to the Beit Yosef. So let's go to the first page of the Beit Yosef. Okay? Let's go to the back to the first page. And look for the Dalid in the Beit Yosef. Does everyone see the Dalid in the Beit Yosef?
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
Now I just want to get a sense. Who here has ever practiced learning Rashi script? Okay, let anyone have some Rashi script experience? Okay, so we're gonna work through a little bit of it, but we're not going to read a lot of it. So he says, Hayaruchev alachamor ein tzarech leredu yipalel. He's just quoting the Torah, right? That's the line in the Torah that we just read. And then he says, okay, Biperek tefilat hashachar. This is in the chapter, tefilat hashachar.
In Brachot.
In Brachot. And then in parentheses, Lamed Amud Aleph, page 30a. So he just told us the chapter in the Talmud. Okay, now you have to know which chapter it is. Chapter in the Talmud is called Tefillat HaShachar, the morning blessings, which happens to be in Tractate Blessings, Brachot.
I was going to ask, how do you know which tractate they're referring to?
Okay, so in this case, you're usually a little bit acquainted, like, Brachot, mm-hmm. Well, Tefillat HaShachar means the morning prayers, so, mm-hmm. So whatever, that may be something you don't know, but a little bit of acquaintance with it, okay? Mm-hmm. And what page? Lamed Amud Aleph, 30a.
Did the page existed at that time?
Yeah, the page existed. Yeah, they had the same.
There was already.
They had the same. Well, actually, the truth is, Lamed Amud Aleph here may have been added in by the editors.
Must have
the
been
editors who did this version of the Torah.
Because
this is, by the way, this is an incredible work right here. They redid its most dochir advar. They redo everything. That may have been added in by the editors.
It may have been added. Yeah.
You're right. It's very good. Time, very good. The pages, the pagination that we have today is only from the Vilna Shas. That was probably edited by the editors. Okay.
Rabbi, so wait, this is the Torah.
No, the Torah is in the middle of the page that we read already.
This is
a Beit Yosef. Look at the top right column. You see?
The
Torah is in the middle. The Torah is in the middle. Okay. It's the same thing. The Beit Yosef is a commentary on the... He uses the Torah to write his extensive commentary on all of the Talmud. It's the same thing. I photocopied from it. It's the same thing. Okay? So Beperek Tefillat HaShachar. This is in the chapter Tefillat HaShachar, which is in Tractate Brachot 30a. And I was going to quote the Talmud for you. You have at your fingertips hyperlink number one, the Talmud. Okay? Tanu Rabbanan, Hayarochev alachamor, a person is riding on a donkey, vigiaz manhatfila, and the time for prayers comes. Im yeshlo mishe ochazet chamoro yered lamitavi palel. If someone can hold his donkey, then he should get down and pray standing. Vim lav, but if not, yeshev bim komovi palel, but if not, sit in his place and pray. Okay, that's the first opinion. Is that the opinion quoted in the Torah? No. According to the Torah, you stay on that donkey. According to this opinion, you have to get off the donkey.
It's a stomach.
But now, that's the Tanakhama, the first opinion. But now he brings the second opinion. Rebbe Omer, a guy named Rebbe says, Bein kach uvein kach yeshev bimkomo v'yipalel. Either this or that, you can sit on your donkey and pray. Whether you have someone to saddle your donkey or not. Why? Because if you have to get off your donkey, you're not going to be able to focus when you pray. You're going to be thinking, oh, the guy might take my donkey, he might go somewhere with it, what's going to happen? Better to stay on the donkey. That's the opinion that we quote in the Torah. And now he continues on one more line in the Gemara. Amar Rava v'itim Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Rava says, and some say Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, halacha kirebi. The halacha is like Rebbe. And so the Gemara tells us that the halacha is like Rebbe. And that's why the Torah quotes this opinion of Rebbe, that you could stay on your donkey and you don't need to get off your donkey. Okay? Does that make sense? You see how he's given us hyperlink number one? The source is in the Talmud.
But if you're in a plane and you're not afraid of losing your seat...
We got a lot more to read here. We got to write. This is just the beginning. We're not going to read any more here for now. But you'll just see the chatfu hatosvot. You see that? Then he quotes the Tosfot. What does Tosfot have to say? They say halacha k'rebi. They say the halacha is also like Rebbe. And then go to the next parentheses. You just see, you go by the parentheses, he quotes. He quotes, you see, v'chein ha-mordechi and the harosh. Next parentheses, harav yosef. Next parentheses, harashpa. And then the next part, v'chatav harokeach. You see, he's quoting all of the Rishonim. All of these medieval scholars are being quoted here in his commentary, right for you on a silver platter, or, to use the terminology of Rav Yosef Cairo, on a set table. Okay, all they're going to get to the Shulchan Aruch. And Beit Yosef is organized his home. Okay, everything in its place. Okay?
Why are they called the Rishonim since they're not the first ones?
Okay, they're called the Rishonim by the people who became the Achronim. Okay, meaning it's arbitrary.
What are the Achronim?
The Achronim, well, basically, the Rishonim are from 1000 until 1500. Rav Yosef Cairo is the one who ends the period of the Rishonim because he says, Talmudic commentary is over. We just pick between the opinions that already were. Okay? It's like you have a poem. You can only give two or three interpretations. That's it. It's closed. And then finally you have the Achronim are 1500 to 1900, whatever it is. Okay, we're going to end here. If you have other questions, great. But guys, Chazak uvaruch. Shkoach for the learning.
Okay.
We'll continue with this. We have not, now realize, we haven't gotten to the Shulchan Aruch yet. We have no idea what the Shulchan Aruch is. We're going to get to that next week, and we're going to see how the Ashkenazim are going to respond to this massive project that was put forward and funded by the Svaradim. Okay, because this is a Sephardi project, the Rambam, the Rif, the Rush gets is a third, right? Not majority. So we're going to see how the Ashkenazim respond. That will be next week. Thank you so much, Daniel, for hosting and organizing the food.
Yes,
and pleasure to learn with you guys. And we'll see you next week.
So okay. Can I?